All right, we are in Genesis 42, and we will read the entire chapter. When Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us there, that we may live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain. Went down to buy grain in Egypt. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph was governor over the land. He was the one who sold all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came, and they bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. And Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. "Where do you come from?" he said. They said, "From the land of Canaan to buy food." And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them. And he said to them, "You are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." And they said to him, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies." And he said to them, "No, it's the nakedness of the land that you have come to see." And they said, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more." But Joseph said to them, "It is as I said to you, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you, and let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested whether there is truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." And he put them all together in custody for 3 days. On the third day, Joseph said to them, "Do this and you will live, for I fear God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households, and bring your youngest brother to me. So your words will be verified, and you shall not die." And they did so. Then they said to one another, "In truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us and did not listen. That is why this distress has come upon us." And Reuben answered them, "Did I not tell you not to sin against the boy? But you did not listen. So now there comes a reckoning for his blood." They did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. And then he turned away from them and wept. And he returned to them and spoke to them. And he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. And Joseph gave orders to fill their bags with grain and to replace every man's money in his sack and to give them provisions for the journey. This was done for them. Then they loaded their donkeys with their grain and departed. And as one of them opened his sack to give his donkey fodder at the lodging place, he saw his money in the mouth of the sack. He said to his brothers, "My money has been put back. Here it is in the mouth of the sack." And at this their hearts failed them. And they turned trembling to one another, saying, "What is this that God has done to us?" When they came to Jacob, their father, in the land of Canaan, they told him all that had happened to them, saying, The man, the Lord of the land, spoke roughly to us and took us to be spies of the land. But we said to him, 'We are honest men. We have never been spies. We are 12 brothers, sons of our father. One is no more, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan.' Then the man, the Lord of the land, said to us, 'By this I shall know that you are honest men. Leave one of your brothers with me and take grain for the famine of your households and go your way. Bring your youngest brother to me, then I shall know that you are not spies, but honest men, and I will deliver your brother to you, and you shall trade in the land.' As they emptied their sacks, behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when they and their father saw their bundles of money, they were afraid. And Jacob, their father, said to them, 'You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more, and Simeon is no more. And now you would take Benjamin. All this has come against me." Then Reuben said to his father, "Kill my two sons if I do not bring him back to you. Put him in my hands, and I will bring him back to you." But he said, "My son shall not go down with you, for his brother is dead, and he is the only one left. If harm should happen to him on the journey that you are to make, you would bring down my gray hairs with sorrow to Sheol." Thus ends the reading of God's holy word. So we are now back in the Joseph story. And when we last left our hero, he had just risen to the most powerful position in Egypt. The only person greater in Egypt is Pharaoh himself. Joseph is essentially authorized to wield the authority of Pharaoh. And this chapter really begins a plot line that stretches all the way through chapter 46. And just as before, in chapters 37 through 41, through the first part of the Joseph story, we saw that there was this kind of, in Joseph's, all of Joseph's suffering, his sale into slavery, his wrongful imprisonment, even being forgotten in prison, all of this was just moving forward, was just continually propelling him towards becoming, where it bringing him to his current position of power. It was just all moving him to the right place at the right time. And similarly, we see in these chapters, in chapter 42 through 46, this chain of events, all these events moving forward, propelling the family of Jacob towards reconciliation. Now, that's a hard word when you think about it. Because it's nice to talk about reconciliation when we're talking about other people and what they need to do. Right? You need to go be reconciled with so-and-so. But when it's you, that's a whole different story. It's hard because reconciliation is demanding. It demands that I let go of my hurt, that I let go of my bitterness and my anger. It requires that I forgive the person who hurt me, or that I seek the forgiveness of the person that I hurt. It requires that I own up to my sin where applicable. It's true that there are, occasions where, you and I are sinned against by another and we actually did nothing wrong. But what's most often, usually what happens is somebody will sin against us, and then we will sin against them back, and then it just becomes a debate about who sinned against who first or more, right? But at the end of the day, everyone actually sinned. And so, as we are getting into the story of reconciliation, again, that stretches for several chapters, we're going to learn a lot about reconciliation, and tonight we're going to learn three things about it. And the first one is that reconciliation often catches us off guard. Look at the first six verses here. It catches us off guard no matter what party we are in the dispute, whether we're the offending party or the offended party. Because you think about it, what is it that prompts the boys to go down to Egypt? Well, it's the same thing that prompted Abraham to go there in Genesis 12. There's a famine. And who was it that sent this famine? The text is more explicit here than it was in Genesis 12, but it's God. And so in essence, God is sending the brothers down to Egypt to see Joseph. And keep in mind that we have actually not heard very much about the brothers for the ongoing, 20 years now? I mean, Joseph was sold into slavery when he was 17. He became the vizier of Egypt when he was 30. And then there were 7 years of plenty after that. So however long into the famine before the brothers came. So you're looking at 20 plus years a time span here. And so, and the only things that we did here were about Judah, and they weren't very encouraging, if you remember Genesis 38. So Jacob, and also notice how kind of Jacob is not exactly soft with his sons here at the beginning. Just kind of, why are you looking around at each other? Why are you sitting around here? Now, I've heard there's food somewhere. Go get some so we don't die. And so he speaks to them, but the fact that he's, the way he speaks to them, also the fact that all the brothers are still together, that teaches us a few things about the current state of the family. Is that, first of all, that the brothers have apparently not been able to establish themselves. Keep in mind, Joseph is now 37 years old. So which means that all his brothers, with the exception of Benjamin, are all in their 40s and 50s. And so they, it seems that the famine has reduced any kind of success that they had, to which that they now must again band together. And there's a little bit of a speculation on my part there, but I'm basing this off of what we learned about Judah in Genesis 38. Because Judah did go out on his own, and he was successful. He had a cord and a staff. He had servants. He had flocks. I mean, he was pretty successful, but here he is back home with the brothers. So apparently, Judah had to come back home. And again, note the tension that seems to be here in the verses. Not only the way that Jacob speaks to his sons, but also notice he doesn't send Benjamin with him for fear that something might happen to him. You know, the last son of Rachel I sent to you guys, it didn't go so well for him. I'm not going to entrust him out. I'm going to keep him safe and keep him home. It's easy to forget that the brothers need reconciliation with Joseph. Just like it's easy to forget the humanity of the people who have hurt us. But God doesn't. He wants these brothers to be together, so he sends them on a rendezvous with their brother. But it's also surprising for the offended party. Because think about this, Joseph, he's just doing his thing. He's administrating brilliantly. That's what he does. He's just administrating like a champ, and he is taking the money, giving the food, he's doing his deal. And then all of a sudden, these 10 guys come in and they bow down before him. And who are they? They're his brothers. And think about the last time he saw them. They sold him into slavery. They were talking about killing him. And they ended up selling him into slavery. The point, though, is that they were surprised. I mean, Joseph had to be surprised to see them. Opportunities for reconciliation often don't come when we expect them, when we're ready for them. More often, it's usually the opposite. It just kind of shows up on our doorstep, and we weren't ready. We weren't looking for it. And there's two kind of examples, that personal examples that come. I remember after becoming a believer, shortly after, God kind of put me in this position where I knew he wanted me to forgive the people who had hurt me in the past. And so, and that was one of those times, one of the many times I've gotten into an argument with God. And so where it was just, and I was at some kind of youth conference, and it was just, and it was a time of prayer, and they had done something, they hadn't been teaching on forgiveness. They don't usually teach on that at youth conferences for some reason. But for whatever reason, during a time of prayer, this was just being hammered in on me. And I just, and I knew God wanted me to forgive them, and I was just like, no, they hurt me. They don't get forgiveness, and it was like the steady waves on a beach, just one after another. It was just, you got to forgive them, and finally I gave up, and I did, and I forgave. And now some of those people I hadn't seen for years at that point, and never saw again. I probably never will. But some of those people I did see, And that enabled me to reconcile with those people. But I wasn't expecting it. It seemed just out of the blue. Another example comes from my father, and I asked him if I could share this with you, and he said, no, I'm going to do it anyway. No, just kidding. No, he said yes. He said yes. But after my parents' divorce, my parents divorced when I was one, and my father was just so angry at my mother. And he spent nearly, at this point in the story I'm going to share with you, 2 decades of just harboring resentment and anger towards her. And then during Christmas, I was on a break from college. I was out in Southern California visiting, staying with my mom. And my dad flew out from Utah to spend a couple of days with my sister and I. And so it was strange in the Mabbitt household to have mom and dad together. I remember we went to Trader Joe's and it was me and mom and dad in the same car. And I was like, this is just weird. This is something wrong about this. And we went to church and after that visit, my dad said that later on that visit impacted him in a massive way, because he saw my mother, who had a few years before that had connected back into church, had reconnected back to her relationship with Christ, and he saw that this was not the same woman that he divorced 20 years ago. And again, the point was, he wasn't expecting that. He was going to go see his kids for Christmas. And all of a sudden, he was given this opportunity for reconciliation. I wasn't looking for it. My father wasn't looking for it. Yet we found it. Or rather, it found us. And let's be honest, it's not it, it's he. Because it is God who initiates these opportunities for reconciliation in our lives. So reconciliation is surprising, but reconciliation also tests our character. You look at verses 7 through 25. Now, Joseph recognizes his brothers, but they don't recognize him. Moses says that twice. And so he takes this as an opportunity to test his brother's character, to see if they've changed, to see if he can trust them. And they don't recognize him, quite honestly, because they think he's dead. And not only that, but if you think about this, is when the last time they saw him, it was, 20 some odd years ago. He was 17. He had, any kind of beard a 17 year old can grow. He had, the 17 year old Hebrew garb on, the coat. Here, he's clean shaven. He's wearing the clothing of Egyptian royalty. And not only that, he's not speaking Hebrew. He's not talking to them directly. He's using an interpreter. And so, it's no surprise. We wouldn't recognize our closest relative under the same circumstances. And so he questions them in verses 7 to 17. And now think about it. Joseph knows even less than you and I do at this point. We've got gobs of details because we read Genesis 38 on Judah. He doesn't know anything about them. And so the last time he saw these guys, they sold them into slavery. And so here they are in the midst of the famine looking for food. And so Joseph wants to find out about his dad and about Benjamin. Because, and I'm not the one who pointed this out, a bunch of commentators made this point, that simply if the brothers had nearly killed him, and would they not also be the same as treacherous with their father and with Benjamin, who obviously would be the new favorite since he's the other son of the favorite wife? And so the way he finds out about it is he says, oh, no, you're spies. He accused them. He knows they're not spies, but he says, you're spies. And they claim to be honest men. You've got to wonder if Joseph was alive. Right. Honest men don't sell their brothers into slavery. You know, they're like, oh, we did that, but we've never been spies. So, no, but, and so he says, look, and so he accuses them of being spies, and their response, and the whole conversation is a little puzzling if unless you think it through. Because their evidence for not being spies is they tell him more details about their family. No, we're not spies, we've got two more brothers. One's not anymore. He's either dead or somewhere. We don't know where he is. What happened to him? And the other one's with her father. And so, and the point they're making is, look, if we were spies, our father would not send all of us down here. He would have sent one of us or two of us. And look, we're just a family. They're just kind of giving more details in the hopes that he'll understand that. But also notice that Joseph responds when they say, oh, we've got two more brothers. He says, aha, you didn't send them all. You're definitely spies. And again, he's pressing the same line. Police do this, by the way. This is a form of interrogation. they'll go the same route and won't change because they want to see if you change your story. They'll say, oh, no, this is exactly what happened. This must be what happened. And even if it's completely untrue, they'll keep running that line because if someone's lying, they'll start changing their story. But the brothers don't change their story. They just add more details to it. And so they give him more details, which is the stuff that he wants to know. And in response, Joseph puts them in jail for 3 days because he says he wants them to bring Benjamin up. Now, in trying to understand what Joseph's doing here, you don't miss verse 9. Verse 9 says what? He remembered his dreams. But if you remember that first dream, he had how many sheaves? 11. There's only 10 brothers there. Joseph wants that 11th brother there. The second dream, he wants his father there. Now his mother's died, but he wants his father there. And so, well, he's doing several things here. First, he's getting information on the welfare of his family. We talked about that. He's testing the character of his brothers to see if they've changed. We're going to talk about that in a second. But also, he is orchestrating things now so that he can be reunited with all of his brothers and his father. Just like when he heard Pharaoh's dream, he set about a plan in response to that dream. Here, he's thinking back to his dream, and now he's in a place where he can execute a plan to bring that dream to fulfillment. And so we test them in verses 18 to 25. And so what is the test? There's a variety of opinions here. There's something some people think is just there's just one test. Others see three tests over several chapters. I read one author who identified 7 different tests in this chapter by itself. I do not want him as a teacher. I think it's better just to see this as a period of testing with various aspects to it, or multiple parts. Because Joseph is trying to discern one key thing here. Have the brothers changed? And so the test is obviously not whether they're spies or not. It's obviously not. But his test is really is to keep one of the brothers there and to see what the brothers do. He gives them all their money back, which is kind of it's a little vague, though, because in doing so, the reason they get scared is because now he can claim that they've stolen from him. They didn't pay for what they bought. So the question is, how faithful are they going to be to their brother Simeon? They sold Joseph for 20 pieces of silver. He's given them a lot more than that. As one author wrote, are they just going to take the money and run? We don't know. Will they return? But he gets part of his answer before they leave about their character. You look at verses 21 to 23 and you see the brothers confessing their guilt regarding what they did to Joseph. And they see this as divine retribution for what they did. And notice that they not only acknowledge their guilt, but also their cruelty towards Joseph. They said, he begged us. We saw the anguish of his soul. And we wouldn't listen. And also notice that they are not protesting the punishment like Cain did. They're actually saying, nope, this is why it's coming. And we deserve it. Essentially. It's hard to understand Reuben here because he just gives you a nice big fat, I told you so. Didn't I tell you not to do it? Now we're paying the price. Most take a negative view on Reuben, and I agree, but his guilt still remains because he still was a part of the ruse by his silence. He didn't tell his father what really happened. Part of reconciliation requires us to confess our guilt, our sin. Ken Sandy, in his book, The Peacemaker, he calls this getting the log out of your own eye. One of the first steps to reconciling with someone is to confess my guilt, my sin against them. Regardless of what they've done to me. Doesn't mean it doesn't excuse their sin, but it owns the fact that I have sinned. There is an ownership of sin that needs to take place. You know that person that never owns up, right? They've always got an excuse for everything, no matter what it is. There's always some outside circumstance. There's some kind of thing that just, it wasn't my fault. I would have been there. I would have done it. I would have, and they never really own it. Even when they apologize, you know? I had somebody that was mad at me about something one time, and it was an old college friend, and I apologized, and I was trying to kind of get things on a smooth things over with him and talk things through with him, but I also pointed out that he said some hurtful things to me, and he was like, "Well, I'm sorry I had to sink down to your level." And I was like, "Well, that's an apology of sorts." But there's sometimes we make those apologies. Sometimes I've made those kinds of apologies. Well, I'm sorry that you were offended. You know, it's like, I'm sorry you're so thin-skinned. You know, it's just, where's the point where we just go, look, I'm sorry. And there's a point where you owning your sin can just lower the threat level. Right? So, but it is necessary if you want to reconcile. That is the thing that we must do. And we see also here in the brothers' conscience, in their collective conscience, that they're still burdened by what they did so rashly more than 20 years ago. It's not something that they just explained away or justified. This is a bad thing and we're paying for it. Their regret is real. And we have to ask ourselves, who needs the reconciliation more at this point? Joseph or the brothers? The answer is both. And how does Joseph respond? Yeah, that's right. Stew in it. He weeps. He can't control himself. And this tells us that Joseph is not getting even with his brothers. He's not just messing with them because he's got power now. He wants to be reconciled with them. There's something that stirs in his heart because of their response. And so for reconciliation to work, we have to desire two things above all. We have to desire the glory of God. Above all, we have to desire the glory of God. For reconciliation to work, we also have to desire the other person's good. And that can be hard. Because when you're trying to reconcile with someone who has harmed you and hurt you, they hurt you. They sinned against you. And we have sinned against others. And so reconciliation tests our character. Why do we want to be reconciled with that person? Do we desire God to be glorified? Do we long to be restored with the other person? Or do we just really want some good old-fashioned groveling? We just want them to come and say, I am sorry I even thought to ever offend you. Or what is our desire? Reconciliation tests our character. Do we like hanging on to our anger? Do we like our self-righteousness? And finally, reconciliation isn't easy. When you look at verses 26 through 38, it's not easy because we tend to want to hold on to pain. Jacob's response is very revealing. The sons come home, they tell him everything that happened, and they tell him about the accusations, the money, the demand for Benjamin to return to get more food. And let's be honest, they really have been honest men here. They've come back and they reported everything. They've been on the up and up this whole time. They obeyed their father. And in response, Jacob tells them that they are responsible for making him childless. He says, Joseph's dead, Simeon's as good as dead, and now you want to take Benjamin. And note verse 38. And if you're an only child, then imagine you have multiple siblings. You're standing in front of your father, and he says about one of your siblings, he's the only child I got. Benjamin's the only one I got left. All Jacob sees are his losses. So much so he can't see the 10 sons before him. Reuben's suggestion is not helpful. The whole idea was to protect the son of Jacob. It's not very helpful to offer to kill two of your own sons if you fail to bring him back. Again, just like before with Joseph in the well, Reuben tries to do the right thing, but he goes about it the wrong way. He can't follow through. He lacks courage. But think about it. If only Jacob knew, he would gladly send Benjamin, wouldn't he? If Jacob knew Joseph was alive and Joseph was the one demanding, take it. I'm coming. I'm coming myself. Jacob needs reconciliation. But it's going to take some serious prodding. Actually, it's going to take near starvation to force him to send Benjamin up. And let's be honest, sometimes it takes an act of God to move people to reconciliation. Sometimes only circumstances in life will finally press someone to be willing to sacrifice what it takes to get on the path towards reconciliation. When I've exhausted all other avenues, I've tried everything else, finally, this is the only path left open to me. But as we know, because we know the Joseph story, because we've read ahead, the results of reconciliation are worth the risk. And going back to that story about my dad, he was so impacted by that visit with my mom that he went back to Utah and he told my stepmother, Heather, he said, we're going to church. And so they went and found a local Christian church and they started going. My father recommitted his life to Christ and my stepmother came to faith. And then in 2004, where all of us had gathered at the hospital, including my father and my stepmother, during the last days of my grandfather's life, I saw the most amazing sight. I saw my mother go up to my stepmother and put her arms around her and call her sister. I wasn't expecting that. And you don't get that apart from an act of God. And we'd ask ourselves, I remember seeing that go, how does that happen? How does that happen? And the thing was, it happens when God gets involved with a family. And it does happen. Because reconciliation is only possible because we have a God who initiated reconciliation with us. We have a God who has reconciled us to Himself through His Son. The Son who has paid for the guilt of our sin and offers us the righteousness that we desperately need and the eternal life that our souls yearn for. If we simply confess our sinfulness and entrust ourselves to Christ. Let's pray.